I did kind of prepare something, but for various reasons, I'm not so sure that I would like to give it. So one possibility is that this would be for us to just have a discussion, for you to ask questions about practice that you might have or Buddhism. We don't do that very often, and sometimes when we do that, it's very rich, very useful to do that. So what would you like to do? Try that? Oh, anybody has any questions that they'd like to ask or any concerns they have about practice? Please, Tasha. The ones with kind of like a striped shirt, sweaters. Yes. So you said want to know about the kinis? You're going to Punta Serena? Okay. Well, there are job openings for such people. I don't know much about the Dakinis. They're in the Tibetan tradition, and they're. I shouldn't be speaking about them. I don't know much about. Joan.
Could you tell about the Zen tradition of the sacred ox?
The sacred ox. Ox herding pictures. Oh, the ox herding pictures. Maybe I should give a talk on the ox herding pictures one day. It's been a while. I've done that, right? Some of you heard it before. Rainbow's heard it before. She wants to hear it again. Now? Mm-hmm. Right. I'll give a talk one of these Mondays on the ox-herding pictures. I think I should give a whole talk on it. Generally, the ox is a symbol for enlightenment. And so the ten ox is a depiction of the search, the quest, and the attainment, and the letting go of enlightenment. So that at first you don't have a clue what it is, so you're looking, and then you just see the footprints. You know, now I know at least where it is. And so you follow the footprint. You haven't seen it yet, but you kind of, you know, something has given you an indication of what direction you're going. And so you follow the footprints, and then finally someday you see it. And that's good. However, you know, it's only still far in the distance. And then you manage to catch it. Hold on for dear life, because it's really wild. It pulls you along in the bush and up in the mountains, and you get all kind of bruised, kind of being pulled along with this big ox. But finally it gets tamed, and you tame it. And then when the ox is finally tamed, well, some people say the ox is a symbol of the mind or enlightenment. But finally you tame the ox. And then you bring it home, and you get to go home with the ox. You find your home, and then you take it easy and hang out at home. But that's not the end, of course. And then at some point the ox, you disappear, but the ox remains. But that's not the end either. And then the ox disappears. There's no ox, no you, and there's nothing. Everything disappears. Just emptiness. But emptiness is not the end. And then there's one of the pictures is just of nature. Just all of nature is there. You know, the self-centered, anthropocentric kind of sense of life disappears, and just our place in nature. But that's not the end. And the final end is there's no ox. And in the beginning of the series, It's just a very young person, a young boy or a young girl who's kind of ox herd or looking for the ox. And then by the end, it's an old person who, full of wisdom, comes back into the, returns to the marketplace with gift-bestowing hand. Returns to the regular life of Palo Alto to help out. Yes.
There's something about the language of quality and the relationship to Sanskrit,
or is there... Pali is a sacred language of Theravadan Buddhists. It's kind of like the church Latin. And the word Pali means text, means book. So it really is a book language. It's related to Sanskrit in the same way that maybe French is related to Latin. However, Sanskrit itself, the word Sanskrit literally means constructed. It itself, Sanskrit is a constructed language. Wasn't exactly ever really a kind of spoken language per se, except among the educated. Pali is more closely connected to the spoken languages of the time of the Buddha than it is to Sanskrit. So there's like, you know, dozens of these Indian languages. Relationship to Sanskrit as Spanish and Portuguese and French has to Latin. And to church Latin. More like a church Latin, kind of, right? So Sanskrit is kind of like a church Latin. And then Pali is our church Latin. Does that make some sense? And it's not what the Buddha spoke, but it's pretty close.
What countries do we speak?
Well, no one ever really spoke Pali except because it's a text language, except for some, mostly just monks who study a lot and learn it, and some people are fluent in it. The language of Magadha, Buddha spoke, was the dialect of Indic language that was spoken around northern India, northeastern India at the time of the Buddha. And Pali survives as a language is used kind of for church purposes in Sri Lanka, Burma, and Thailand. So people who like to study kind of, you know, the original texts in Buddhism will study Pali. Yes?
Jill, would you like to talk about God in relation to Buddha this evening?
It's easier to talk about oxes. So the relationship of God to Buddha. Well, the God that we have in the West, or the God, you know, the gods that we have here in the West, the Buddha didn't know about. However, the idea that there is a creation God, a God that created the universe, did exist. That idea did exist in India at the time of the Buddha.
Really?
But yeah. But that creation God, they had a whole pantheon of gods.
Oh.
And the Buddha once told a story about how the God who took himself to be the creation God, how it was a misunderstanding. It was a certain kind of conceit. And the story, well, you want to hear the story? Okay, so in the Buddhist theory of cosmology, the world expands and contracts. The universe, the cosmos, expands like a yo-yo theory of the cosmos. And so when everything collapses, then everything kind of melts away. But life doesn't disappear because of rebirth. Life continues forever unless you get enlightened. And so human beings, all beings, then take up temporary residence in some high plane of heaven that is an immaterial heaven. And they're immaterial beings. So they're just kind of like spirits with no bodies, and they hang out there, kind of this, you know, in this kind of immaterial, amorphous realm, until the next time the world begins to expand again, the universe expands, and as the world begins to expand, it begins to coalesce again, And first it becomes this kind of liquid. And that liquid slowly hardens, and then you get the planets and the earth and the mountains, and you know, everything begins to kind of reappear. And as it begins to reappear, one of the first things that reappears is one of the heavenly realms, the highest heavenly realm that's in the material world. So there's like 33 different realms of heavens in Buddhism. So, you know, if you want heavens, we got them. But the highest one of the material realm, you know, after they leave the material plane, they die, and everything dies eventually, so they die in the material heaven. The world expands and gets kind of solidified. The first being to get reborn in the material world gets born in this highest material heaven. Okay? Now, the first being who is reborn in the highest material heaven looks around, and this is great, nice here, but, you know, after a while, it's a he gets lonely, and he says, you know, it sure would be nice to have some more people around here. Now, coincidentally, some other of these immaterial beings, in the immaterial heaven, just at that time, and at that moment gets reborn in the material heaven with Brahma. Poof! It's kind of like spontaneous birth in the heavenly realms. And Brahma thinks that he created the next being. Because it happened right after he had this thought. And then he had a few other thoughts. And then he thought, it would be really nice to have, you know, some humans down below. We can watch and see, kind of, you know, it's kind of like, you know, entertainment to watch what humans do. And just as he had that thought, poof, humans appeared down there in the world. And he thought he created it all. But it was a misunderstanding. Really the Creator God. So that's what the Buddha said about the Creator God.
Well, you talked about the Buddha too much and you talked about a God too little.
Oh. Yeah, okay, so?
I'd like to hear more about God.
More about God. Well, but there's so many different ideas of what God is. So you have to kind of, fill me in a little bit. Which God do you want me to speak about?
I'm talking about God the Creator.
Oh, but maybe it was a misunderstanding.
I once called God energy, but now I think God is the creator of everything.
Nice.
In your talk about Buddha, can I ask a question? Where are we now? You mentioned something about creation or something
Yes.
like that. Where are we now?
Well, I'm not really sure, but I think we're expanding. I think we're in the expansion right now, and every period of expansion has a certain number of Buddhas that can appear, and then at some point everything collapses again, and then there's chaos for a while and apocalypse and all that until everything disappears for a while, and we all take up residence in the material world for a while until the next. And then there can be a certain number of Buddhas that reappear there, but there's something like several million years or 100 million years between Buddhas. So we had the Buddha of our era already happened. The next Buddha is called Maitreya Buddha. And he's hanging out right now up in one of the heavenly realms called Tushita. And Tushita is the heavenly realm that's... there's a lot of joy in that realm. And he's kind of hanging out there until it's the right time for him to be reborn to be the next Buddha. But you don't have to hold your breath for it, because it's a long way off. So probably not very satisfying my answer.
Not really.
I don't talk about God enough.
Jack Kornfield in the After the Ecstasy, the Laundry, talks about God all the time. And he's a Buddhist.
Bless him.
He's a very good Buddhist.
I'm neither a good Buddhist or a good theist. Well, it's interesting, the issue of God. You know, in America, as probably most of you know, level of belief in God. I think the Gallup poll does, you know, surveys of the belief, how many people believe in God in America, and I mean, it's in the 90 percentile. You know, 97% of Americans believe in God. Then you could ask, you know, what, when they believe in God, what do they believe in? Not all of those 97%-ish people believe in the creation God. They believe in something else like energy or creative force. And then, but then you have some like 87% of the population who believe in heaven. But very interestingly, you always have a smaller percentage of people who believe in hell. I thought that was always very odd. Together the package. If there's heaven, I thought there has to be hell, right? But I guess there isn't such a way. I guess Mormons don't have hell, do they? I think they do. Mormons, just there's a very, very rosy picture. Just you keep getting better. I think if you're Mormon, it only gets better. They have this wonderful, you know, just, and if you're a Mormon, you actually become a god. Eventually, we're all headed in that direction. We'll become gods ourselves. So it's kind of like in some schools of Mahayana Buddhism, they believe that everyone's headed toward Buddhahood. It's kind of like, you know. And I don't know if I'm getting in trouble here.
Isn't that true of Vipassana too?
In Vipassana?
Yeah.
The word that was true about it?
That everybody is headed toward Buddha.
Not exactly. There are two ideal goals for people pursuing the goal of freedom or liberation. And there's actually three ideal kind of culminations of the spiritual path. And one culmination is called the Arhat path. The other is the path of the Pratyeka Buddha. And the third path is the path of the Buddha. Each of them attains full awakening, full enlightenment, full freedom. The Pratyeka Buddha is a very rare breed of person who is self-enlightened, self-liberated, who has never heard any teachings from anyone, any Buddha, any Buddhists, and haven't read any book by Jack Kornfield. and somehow figured out on their own. But for a reason that is maybe, you know, why, maybe it's Buddhist propaganda, the teaching is that those beings can never teach. So they don't teach. They're called solitary Buddhas. And then there's the Arhats. And the Arhats are ordinary people who become fully enlightened. Buddhas are not exactly ordinary people. And for one thing, one of the primary definitions of a Buddha is someone who is the first one to be enlightened in a particular world system. The Buddhas before. So it's like the pioneer, the discoverer. And like you say, you know, as long as you're not Norwegian, we say that, you know, Christopher Columbus, or Native American, we say that, you know, Christopher Columbus discovered the Americas. And, you know, after Christopher Columbus discovered the Americas, he was, you know, we don't have the next discoverer because it was discovered, right? So the Buddha discovered the path to awakening. And so then after that, people just followed in his footsteps that he blazed. So the Buddha was the first one. So the Buddhas don't happen very often. So to pursue Buddhahood is considered in Theravada tradition. It's possible for everyone to pursue Buddhahood, but it's not considered very practical to do it, because that means you're Maitreya is the next Buddha to happen. And so it means you have to do that even after Maitreya, because it has to be in sequence. You know, you get a number. And so it's, you know, way down the line that you're going to become a Buddha yourself. So it's better just, you know, do the work yourself and in this lifetime. And so the Theravada Buddhism, they tend to focus on the ideal, the arhat, who becomes fully awakened in this lifetime. And so that's why, you know, in Vipassana, we don't say, but rather we're all going, in a sense, some of us might go to Buddha, but some of us, most people, are going towards arhat. That makes sense?
Yeah.
And but you know, I realize that I'm not satisfying probably what was very, very important for you, some question between God and Buddhism. And if you have more questions, I'll try to answer. Or some other. Okay. I'm respectful of your you know, your concerns, but it's a little bit hard for me to answer.
Yeah. Okay.
Yes.
Brahma.
The Creator God, he thinks. He's the deity of the Indian pantheon at the time of the Buddha. It was, you know, something like that. Yes, Don.
You know, what is that nature of Buddha's enlightenment? Did he say, I woke up and had these ideas and even visited? Did the Christians have this kind of visited visitation by some kind of spirit? What's the nature of the experience of this enlightenment?
Yeah, it's hard to know. However, there is in the suttas, in the discourses of the Buddha, some descriptions of what happened to him in the night of his awakening. He had three sets of visions before his awakening, and the visions weren't necessary parts of the process of enlightenment. But for his case, because he was the first one to find the awakening, they were very useful, these visions, to have. And after these visions that he had, he eliminated, eradicated, or plucked out what's called the asavas. And the asavas mean something like the contaminants, the outflows, the taints. The word asava means is related to the etymology of the word is kind of interesting, because it means the intoxicating part of certain plants in ancient India. So the that intoxicates people. It's also a word for the pus that oozes out of a wound. So the asavas are kind of like, you know, a problem. And so the definition of the Buddha's awakening, the definition of anyone's awakening in Buddhism, in negative terms, what a person has become freed of. The fetters, the bonds, the constrictions of the heart that keep the person's heart limited, or the mind constricted or tightened. And so the night of the Buddha's awakening, he broke free from all the different fetters that bind the person, bind the heart, and the heart was set free. So I don't know if that was a satisfying answer, but.
He didn't say, I was told this from another spirit, he just simply, something just happened in
your
life.
Yeah, it happened. He discovered, he didn't have any teachers per se. However, he did say what he discovered was an ancient path. So he doesn't claim that he invented it, but rather he found an ancient path that all Buddhas, all enlightened people will follow that path. But it wasn't like a spirit that came to him and pointed it out. And I mean, if you want some evening, I could give a whole talk on the enlightenment of the Buddha. You like that? Really? Well, that's interesting. I kind of assume no one would really want. It's such a, you know, it's kind of like theology. It's kind of like, kind of, you know, I thought you wanted something more practical. So like when I showed up in San Jose many years ago to give a talk in Santa Cruz Sitting Group, I was going to give a talk on liberation. But before I was going to do that, I said, well, But do you have any questions before I start? And so we spend the whole evening talking about anger. So that was more interesting. Yes, Kate? Yeah.
In New York over Thanksgiving, I was introduced to a Buddhist who is an atheist who is very attached to his atheism, and moreover has just published a 1,300-page book called Who Do It Help? I didn't want him to think I was anything in Catholic religion, so I said, I'm a Buddhist and I'm not sure I consider that a religion. I think it's more a philosophy because we don't worship the Buddha as a god. And he said, no, it's a religion, it's just a non-theistic one. And that was completely over my head.
Well, you know, it's a little bit, awkward to these kinds of questions because it has a lot to do with how we define our words. You know, in the United States, Buddhism is definitely religion because you get non-profit status. In the old Soviet Union, Buddhism was definitely not a religion. The Buddhists would say, "No, we're not a religion," because in a Marxist society, religion was the problem. So Buddhism is quite flexible, you know. It's whatever. We're fine with whatever you want to call us. So it really helps, I think, if you're talking to someone. Ask them what their definition of religion is, rather than, because otherwise you might be having different definitions and missing each other. So ask them, what is religion for you? And if people begin defining religion as a spirituality, as a spiritual tradition, then it tends to be able to find much more commonality. Because at the realm of spirituality, there's a lot of similarity between people and different religions. At the level of religion, which sometimes, I don't know what it is, but for example, religious doctrine, it's like, this doesn't make any sense to me when you talk to each other. But as soon as you start talking about what people do in their practice and how it affects their hearts and their minds and the relationship to the world around them, there's a lot of commonality. Brother David Stendelrust, who's a Catholic monk, has said that he feels he has more in common with Buddhist monks than he does with ordinary Christian lay people, because they share the monastic life together, spirituality. So, it depends how you define it, and what you're looking for. And I know in modern America, spirituality has become very popular. It seems like the word religion has generally kind of a negative connotation nowadays, but spirituality is getting very positive. So maybe being spiritual, but will not identify themselves being religious. So is what?
That 9%.
So is Buddhism a religion? I think that in a sense, I'm comfortable calling Buddhism a religion because it has to do with orientation towards life, but it's all encompassing. It includes your whole life, your whole frame of reference, your whole being. Your whole relationship to the nature and the world around you is included. Sometimes I like to distinguish spirituality from religion by saying that spirituality has to do with personal relationship with what's ultimate. And religion is how you express that to your community. Because the word religion, religare in Latin, means to bind together, that which binds together. So it's how you share your spirituality with the community of people you live with. That's what religion is. And spirituality is the more personal, inner part. But yeah, that's just a definition. You can make up your own. Why? Last one, Fiona, and then we should stop and let the homeless come in.
This idea
I think some of those stories of cosmology is interesting with mythic quality, mythic role. Some of them are beautiful myths, and myths, you know, have their own truth, you know, even though they may not be literally true. You'll find Buddhists who believe the Buddhist cosmology literally. Sometimes you wonder if you read some of these sutras that the Buddha was kind of talking tongue-in-cheek, like the story of Brahma's mistake. You know, he was just making a fancy story, and everyone knew it back then. But then later, they take it as the gospel, you know. So you certainly find Buddhist fundamentalists who believe these things absolutely. Most Buddhists that I've met in Asia, and my teachers and here in America, don't feel there's much need for much of Buddhist cosmology. It has no real bearing on enlightenment. You don't hear me talk about it very much. The one place where there's some controversy around this that's related to cosmology is about the importance of the belief in rebirth. And some Buddhists will believe very strongly that Buddhism doesn't make any sense unless, and you kind of need to believe it in order to kind of really be a good practicing Buddhist. And other Buddhists feel that belief in rebirth is completely unnecessary. You can be an agnostic, you can be an atheist about rebirth. You know, it has no bearing on whether you get enlightened or not. So there's a controversy, and that controversy was expressed very clearly in a Tricycle interview some years ago, and a debate between Robert Thurman, who took the rebirth side, and Stephen Batchelor, who took the agnostic side. So I wish I could. Buddhists say you don't have to bother with this stuff. I can tell you that, but I can't speak for other Buddhists. You know, you have to remember that Buddhism is a huge spiritual tradition. It's quite ancient. You know, all the diversity you find in Christianity, you know, and Christianity is younger than Buddhism. And you find a tremendous diversity of teachings in Buddhism. So it's a little bit of a fallacy to kind of come up and say, oh, Buddhists believe this, as if that stands for all Buddhists. And so it makes it, you know, be nice if we could have the clarity of just knowing this is the way it is. On the other hand, we don't want the religion to tell us this is the way it is. And the last thing I'll say is that my teacher Pandita wrote a book, or published a book, his one book in English, and the title of it is In This Very Life. So In This Very Life, we're right here. So thank you all, and I appreciated this, your questions, and I guess there'll be a couple of Dharma talks out of this.